Welcome. Please be seated. Welcome to the Arizona Court of Appeals for Division One. We're here this morning to hear an oral argument in the matter Kalamata Three Brothers LLC versus Tahan Law Office PLLC. It's our case number CACV 250745. As you're probably aware, these proceedings are both broadcast on YouTube and recorded and available later on YouTube. So for the benefit of that record and anyone who may be watching, when you rise to the podium, please state your name and also the name of your client. As far as time goes, you can see the 20 minutes on the dais there as you face us. And although if you ask us 3 or 4 minutes you want to reserve as appellant, we'll try to do that. Ultimately, that's up to you to mind your time and take care of that. So with that, appellant, when you'd like to begin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Honors. May it please the court. I'm Caroline Larson with the law firm of Thorpe Schwer on behalf of appellants Raya Tahan and Tahan Law Office PLLC. I'm here this morning asking the court to reverse and remand the trial court's denial of the Tahan appellant's motion for relief from a default judgment that was entered against them. Reversal is warranted based on any one of the numerous procedural errors that preceded the entry of this default judgment. Probably most concerning, first of all, is that the judgment is void for lack of personal service. There is no dispute based on the record before this court and that was before the trial court that neither of the appellants were ever personally served or otherwise had any means to have notice that an action had been filed against them.
Counsel, that your client does not dispute that there was an order allowing alternative service, correct? I mean, such a thing exists in our record, correct?
That is correct. Okay. We do not dispute that the court, which kind of segues into the same jurisdictional and procedural issue, the court did enter an order allowing for alternative service. However, it's concerning that that order was based on a material misrepresentation in the application for leave to seek alternative service. And what is also procedurally concerning from a due process perspective is that the record also clearly establishes that despite an order allowing for Kalamata, for appellees to effect service by making 2 attempts at personal service and then serving the...
Two additional attempts, like they had already made attempts before that.
Before seeking leave to serve by alternative means, the appellee had sent a process server to the office, the former office of Tahan Law Office, which had been closed. So it's a little unclear why they went to the same office.
It was very simple.
Shut down.
They had made attempts. You might not like the thoroughness of those attempts, but they had made attempts previously, and then they got an order that said, try twice more, and then you can get it.
That is correct. That is correct, Your Honor. The Kalamata appellees had made 2 attempts. The problematic part of the motion for leave for alternative service is that they represented to the court in that motion that they had made, that they had identified a list of addresses and as part of their investigation or attempts to find a way to serve, the appellants had identified a residential address and had unsuccessfully attempted service there. That is directly refuted by the affidavits of attempted service by their own process server. But based on that misstatement of the record, the court did allow did agree that alternative service was available to the Kalamata appellees.
And just to be clear, the attempted service order said try twice more and then specified specifically that exact residential address. Is that not so?
Indirectly, what the court had ordered in its alternative service motion was
To serve on whoever the subpoena came from.
Correct, whatever
which
address.
Which was that residential address, correct?
We believe so now. That was never clarified for the court. There was no indication that the subpoena or whatever address or addresses had been obtained was presented to the court as part of the confirmation that service was purportedly completed or the application for default. So it was only in the briefing on this motion for relief that Kalamata then filed, provided the response of the, from the subpoena to the state bar, which confirmed the 35th Street address in Phoenix, which they had had at all times prior to seeking leave for alternative service, and at which they had never attempted service, and which, as part of their service attempts, they seemed to confirm was in fact an appropriate address, because at one point when they when the process server attempted service, they were advised that the appellant Tahan was not there, that she was out of town, again confirming that that was probably a feasible address.
Okay, so let's take all of that and let's put it to the side, and come back to my question, which is that ultimately the process server did attempt service at that address.
Correct.
You would agree with that?
Yes, that we don't dispute that fact.
Okay, thank you.
And then that was the prerequisite per the service order for alternative service for the Kalamata appellee to attempt service via certified mail. And that's where I think things go sideways. In the order allowing alternative service, the court specifically directed the Kalamata appellee to serve the complaint package, the summons and complaint and related documents via certified mail return receipt requested. The process server did that after the unsuccessful service attempts at the 35th Street address, approximately 3.5 weeks later. That service package was returned undeliverable to the process server who mailed it. That is the only attempt at service that conceivably could have reached the appellants, and it indisputably did not. It was returned. At no point has Kalamata refuted that.
I believe the record says it was returned to sender, correct? It was marked return to sender?
It was returned undeliverable to sender. The return address was the process server who completed the affidavit of service. So the process server and Yvette Owens certified that she'd attempted address. The above-named documents were sent by certified mail, return receipt requested to the 35th Street address, and then that package came back to the process server's office. That's the return address, marked, yes, undeliverable or
return not, to sender?
Return to sender. I think there was a notation that nobody actually understood. It's some kind of abbreviation marked on it, but the documents came back undelivered. So there's several problems there. First, there's no dispute that because this was the only means for the complaint and summons and related documents to get in the hands of the appellants and they were returned, there's no question that the appellants were never personally served. The idea behind the concept between alternative service is to give a plaintiff who's pursuing a claim a way to serve a defendant who may be difficult to track down, who may be evading service, but it's not a technicality. It is actual service that establishes the court's jurisdiction. So in this instance, the Kalamata appellees clearly presented to the court that no service had occurred. And with that information, no additional attempts were made to inform the defendants that there was a lawsuit against them.
Does that argument presuppose that, as your opposing counsel suggests, that compliance with the order for alternative service is not affecting service?
Absolutely.
Okay, I mean, so then what of, hypothetically, the situation where you have service by publication?
Interesting that you ask. As they also noted in their briefing documents, the requirements for affecting service by publication are higher as far as the showing by the party seeking to serve by publication about the impracticability of serving the defendants via personal service. And so their argument here was we didn't have to meet that heightened standard because that is specifically for service by publication, with the recognition that the reason for the heightened standard is because it's sort of presumed that the defendant is unlikely to ever see the publication. But here, that heightened standard was not sought, it was not met, and the case was allowed to proceed to default in the face of clear evidence that the defendants had never been personally served. And the rationale for requiring service via certified mail with return receipt seems only makes sense, is only logical to ensure, to have some insurance that they were in fact served. And despite the lack of that assurance, the case was allowed to proceed to default.
So what if, and this isn't, I don't find this in the record, but let's for purposes of the hypothetical, let's say that Ms. Tahan gets these documents in the envelope, knows what they are, writes return to sender on them, and puts them in the mailbox. So under your argument, mm-hmm. she has not been served.
Correct.
Even though she has consciously kept herself from being served. Does that serve the interests of due process?
I guess in the hypothetical, I have a little, you know, there would, no, it wouldn't suffice as far as the fact that due process is a constitutional protection for the defendant.
Someone can stymie judicial process by just writing return to sender and shoving it in the mailbox and then no service. That's your argument.
Well, the rules contemplate that, absolutely. So the court, the alternative options under Rule 4.1 allow for the possibility that a defendant may not answer the door when a process server comes, that they may not accept a mailing, that they might, not want to be sued and may not voluntarily submit themselves to that. But because there needs to be some record of service, of notice, for jurisdiction to attach, the rules allow the parties an end run to that by making an appropriate showing of impracticality. But the Creech case clearly states that service is not complete where the trial court has no factual or documented basis in the record by which to establish complete service on the party. There's no record here. Service was not complete. It is undisputed that service was not complete. And yet the default application was allowed to proceed.
Before we get to the end of your time, I'm really curious. I've never seen a 12-year delay in seeking Rule 60 relief in my career, and I'm kind of old. Why 12 years? Why wait that long to seek relief from this? That's an awfully long time.
It is, and as we noted at the trial court level, the reason is sort of inexplicable, but it's in the hands of the Kalamata appellee. They obtained this judgment in early 2013, and there is no record of any, aside from recording it and the flawed renewal affidavit, there's no indication that they took any action on it until 2025 when they attempted to record it in Louisiana, where they believed that the appellant Tahan had some property. There were errors in that. They cited the wrong case. They corrected it. And then later that year, started to undertake enforcement actions, and that is when the appellant Tahan learned that this case was pending.
So it's your position that it's a reasonable time under Rule 60, no matter how long it is, if collection actions haven't started until recently. That's kind of what I'm hearing.
Not at all. That's not my argument, Your Honor. When there is no service, when there's been no formal process. And the defendant, and as we noted in our papers here, the Tahan defendant no individual copy of the notice of application for default was mailed to her either. So when there's no means for when the defendant isn't aware of the lawsuit at the outset, absent some kind of later enforcement proceedings, unless you do a public records search or, Google yourself. No, there was no means for her to find out. The case, after they obtained the judgment, it just sat there for years, and there was no, with nothing further happening, it was just an old judgment that never came to the appellant's attention until enforcement action started in 2025.
One more quick question. So under Rule 60B6, the catch-all, don't you have to be seeking relief for some basis which is not one of the other bases in the first five subparts of Rule 60B?
Correct, which is why it was an alternative basis for our motion. Our primary argument is that under 60B4, the appellants are allowed to raise these procedural deficiencies at any point and seek relief. And there's no time limit. They don't have to show that they could have done so earlier. The 60B6 was an alternative argument that the trial court, I think, incorrectly interpreted and applied. So you know, that brings us to the entry of the default being entered despite the lack of service, and then the excessiveness of the judgment that was entered, which in and of itself, on the absence of record and in the complete lack of a hearing to establish the damages, is an independent basis under Rule 60b-4 to declare the judgment void. 54D imposes guardrails on the entry of a default judgment that requires that a party set forth in the complaint what relief they're seeking, and that that relief be something they were entitled to under the rules, or under some statutory basis or under a contract. None of those applied here. What it appears happened is that once the defendants, because they were unaware of the lawsuit, defaulted, the appellee treated it as sort of a blank check and filed an application that in no way correlated to anything that was asserted in the complaint, certainly didn't correlate to anything they were entitled to under the rules.
I think in no way is a little strong. I mean, the case law that you're citing talks about someone trying to get or did get a default judgment for setting parenting time when they were going in to amend child support. You're not contesting that the Kalamatas sought a money judgment and in fact got a money judgment, right? You don't dispute that.
Correct. I don't dispute that. Correct.
Okay, so not in any kind might be a little strong.
Well, there is no basis for a party under a tort theory, which is what the negligence legal malpractice claim is, to recover attorney's fees. There's no basis for any party to recover attorney's fees without some kind of indication that those fees were reasonable. None of that was provided. At no point in any of these proceedings have the appellants tried to explain what those damages were.
Well, hold on. A legal malpractice action is a negligence action, but it also is one that arises out of a contract of legal representation. So I'm not clear on why you wouldn't be able to get fees in a legal malpractice case under 12.340.101, and I think people do.
There's two issues there. If a party is suing for actual contract, well, first, the case law generally treats a lawyer representation as quasi-contractual, but under a party can seek attorney's fees if they have a contractual provision that entitles them to do so. No such contract was ever presented to the court. And under 12.341, a default action is not a party where a contested action where the party has prevailed and entitles them to attorney's fees. So no contract was presented to the court that would have fee shifted, and 12.341 was inapplicable in a default action.
Don't the ethical rules have something to say about...
I'm sorry, what is your case for that proposition that you can't get, that a default is not a contested action?
I can certainly provide, I believe, case law, but 12.341... 01 specifically states that in a contested action, the prevailing party is entitled to their fees, and in the cases interpreting that have indicated that a default is not a contested action. And if I can reserve...
No, I'll look at... Oh, I'm sorry.
2 minutes. I'm sorry. If I can reserve 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Sure.
Thank you.
You have 2:24 left. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, I'm Brian Partridge with the Law Office of James R. Vaughan. I'm here for Kalamata Three Brothers. And ultimately, this is a case where the appellants moved to vacate a default judgment after waiting more than a decade. And they did it based on the bare assertion that they just learned about the judgment. They attacked all sorts of procedural issues. They raised all sorts of procedural defects that they allege, including the lack of service, which we've heard more about.
How would they
today.
Prove, you said bare assertion that they just learned about it. How would you prove the negative, like that they didn't know?
Well,
I mean, it seems reasonable, her argument seems very reasonable that there had been no enforcement action and they had no idea this was out there because they'd never been served until you began trying to get money out of them.
So there's nothing in the record that indicate, there's no affidavit or declaration under penalty of perjury from Ms. Tahan saying when she learned of the judgment. All we have in the record is her lawyer saying, well, when they tried to enforce it in 2025 in Louisiana, that's when Ms. Tahan learned about it. But in the response to the motion to vacate, we provided the court with the evidence that showed that the judgment was domesticated in Louisiana and enforcement action had begun in 2023. So there's some dispute about when Ms. Tejon learned about it. We don't actually know if she learned about it when the notice of entry of default was mailed to her, and if she got that mailing and she opened it. We don't know if she learned about the case then or at some point in the next, you know, decade or so after that. So,
but I think your point is that she bears the burden of demonstration in a motion under Rule 60, and she's not putting any quantum of evidence in. That's what you're saying, right?
Essentially, yeah. Okay. She should be able to show, you know, this is when I learned about the judgment. Here's what happened. Here's why I didn't know before, or here's what I was doing before where I did not learn of this. And based on the evidence, there isn't any. There's just her lawyer saying, yeah, this is when she learned about it, and she immediately hired us, and we moved to vacate.
Am I remembering the record correctly that this judgment was recorded sometime shortly after it was issued, like in Maricopa County?
That's correct. It was recorded about 2 months, I think, after it was entered. It was recorded in Maricopa County.
Okay. And that would have been like around 2013-ish?
I'm sorry?
That would have been around 2013-ish?
Yes, that was in 2013.
Okay.
Was there any activity between 2013 and 2023 when you filed your attempted effort in Louisiana?
As far as like court documents that were filed?
Or not, any enforcement or something that should have put her on notice?
Not to my knowledge, but, you know, that sometimes people, well, that was raised below too. And ultimately, you know, the question is how much obligation does my client, Kalamata, have to make efforts to enforce a judgment? And that gets into questions about collectability and locating assets. And with Ms. Tejon, you know,
I'm just talking
leaving
about
the state
for the notice purposes. Is there anything else you could point to in that interim 10 years?
No, okay. I don't think so. So one thing that has been argued here is that the certified mail return receipt process that was used, you know, that was returned undeliverable or unclaimed, but the only real reason to require certified mail return receipt is because then you get the signed certificate showing that someone got it. But that's not exactly true, because the mail carrier, when you send something certified mail return receipt requested, will make two attempts to deliver it, and then they hold on to it for about 2 weeks before they return it. So had Ms. Tejon or anyone, you know, got that notice from the USPS and said, hey, I'm going to go pick that up, they could have. Whereas with first class mail, they only make the one attempt, drop it off in your mailbox, and then they walk away, right? So there's a little bit more involved than just wanting the return receipt signed. Plus, ultimately, Rule 4.1K and the order did not specify that the return receipt was required to complete service. So that's a situation where the appellees are adding on, imposing additional requirements of saying, hey, you know, the goal of service is notice, actual notice. So therefore, since we can prove we didn't get actual notice, service is ineffective. And that's not the law. The law is that the methods that are chosen to serve someone have to be reasonably calculated under all the circumstances to apprise the defendant or the interested parties of the lawsuit and give them a chance to show up and litigate the issues. And I believe under the circumstances that we're dealing with here, you know, Kalamata had not only attempted service, but they'd also hired a PI to try to find Ms. Tejon's residence. And they had said, you know, it's possible she's staying there when she's in Phoenix, but we don't know for sure. They had also, they're in that declaration that my opponent pointed out, there's that representation that they had attempted service at that address. She's right. There's no proof that actually they attempted service at the 35th Street address or Avenue, 35th Avenue address before asking for alternative service. But under the circumstances, this is an unusual alternative service motion and order, because most of the time you do know exactly where the person is when you're trying to serve them by alternative service. In this case, they weren't sure. So they asked for permission to subpoena the state bar and make personal attempts. And then if those things failed, then they could do the certified mail. And that's what happened. They subpoenaed the state bar provided the address, the process server went out there three times, never got a hold of anyone who would accept the documents, and then they mailed it. So that's, I think, sufficient to show impracticability when you're looking at it from where the court was, the Superior Court was below. When you move to vacate a judgment on service, and the records that are available to the court at that moment show that, yeah, this service should be upheld. The Hirsch case said in their case it was publication, but there was missing information in the affidavit supporting the publication in that case. And the Hirsch case said, well, the trial court had proof that of the circumstances that were omitted when it looked at the motion to vacate, and that could be consulted to uphold service. And that's the same kind of situation we have here. At the time, perhaps there could be an argument that the trial court should, you know, exercise discretion and shouldn't have given the motion for granted the motion for alternative service. But even if we said that, and I don't agree that that's the case, but even if we did admit that, then at the motion to vacate stage, the court knew that the process server had been out there 3 times. They had tried to serve her personally. The certified mail situation happened. Like, all of that was known at that moment. So that when they decided to uphold the judgment, they did so with a reasonable basis based on the facts and circumstances that existed.
What's our standard of review, and what exactly are we reviewing? Or how are we applying that standard to each decision? Because it seems to me that one decision is whether the original motion for alternative service was properly granted. But we're reviewing that now through the lens of a much later 60B4 motion. So how? What is our standard review, and what decisions are we applying de novo review, and which ones are we deferring to the fact finding of the Superior Court?
Those are good questions. I believe this.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I believe the standard of review for 60B4 motion challenging service is a de novo review. As I mentioned, the Hirsch case, you know, gives some guidance on whether you can consider later uncovered information that was known to the trial court at the motion to vacate stage, and I think that's appropriate to consider. The other decisions on motions to vacate are abuse of discretion standard, but all of the case law I was able to find say, you know, we're not going to second guess the trial court. We're going to uphold the trial court's findings on disputed facts unless it's clearly erroneous or those kinds of issues arise.
You said de novo, so.
Correct, yeah.
We're applying de novo review to the legal conclusions of the Superior Court on 60B4, but we're deferring to the factual findings underlying that decision? Is that what you're...
Yes, that would be what I think is appropriate here, particularly with service, because the burden to impeach the service is a clear and convincing evidence standard. I think it's appropriate to say, hey, you know, let's look at the facts as the trial court found them to be, and let's, you know, draw the conclusions from there.
To me, the most compelling argument your colleague made on this issue is that the record doesn't contain any evidence that she had actual notice, that she'd been served or had actual notice of this lawsuit being filed. I realize that there's the alternative service overlay above that, but what is your response to that?
I understand that concern, but as Judge Jacobs pointed out earlier, I don't know if the mailing, if she just ignored it, if she got the notice from USPS and said, oh, I don't want to pick up certified mail, only bad news comes from certified mail, right? She's an attorney. She knows how those kinds of things go sometimes. She was an attorney. That's correct. She's been disbarred since. But at the time she was an attorney, and she was operating a law firm that had since, you know, she closed down around the time of the service in this case. But
It is your best answer to her argument. I love when I posit questions and then have my own idea of what the best answer would be. Maybe, but then this is her burden on 60B4 is to provide evidence, and she needed to provide those things that you mentioned earlier, that an affidavit saying I had no idea, something under penalty of perjury, something the court can consider as evidence.
Right. I mean, there's case law that was in our brief that says, you know, hey, the moving party has the burden to provide, to show an entitlement to relief, If you're challenging a service, you have to impeach the, you know, service by clear and convincing evidence. And in the Blair case, I think it was Blair, there's even an affidavit there that says, I first learned of the judgment in, you know, a specific time. We don't even have that here. It could be that she learned of the judgment when the certified mailing happened. It could be that she got the notice of entry of default, and then that's when she learned of it, and she would have had time to file an answer and assert that she hadn't been properly served, and the court could have addressed it at that point. But we don't know. We really have no idea when she actually learned of this lawsuit or how that happened. So to presume that, you know, just because the available records in the documents that we do have seem to indicate that she didn't have knowledge, actual notice, isn't enough. You know, she's got to come in and say, here's when I learned of it, here's what went wrong, here's what I know, and let the court actually look at the evidence. There isn't any. There's just speculation. So I suppose one other thing that I wanted to discuss is one of the arguments that Ms. Tejon and the appellees make is that the judgment was excessive and that means it should be set aside. That's not quite how it works. Under Gonzalez, you know, that's a 60B6 motion. It has to be filed within a reasonable time. And if the judgment is excessive under all the circumstances, then the trial court has the discretion to set it aside. It's a meritorious defense to the claim. It's not necessarily determinative of 60B6. And in this situation, there's no evidence that she moved to vacate it within a reasonable time because we don't know when she learned of it.
I understand that's the ground you've staked out, but really their argument was the court was without authority to enter an excessive judgment. And there is some case law that suggests that that proposition writ large, it is the law. So
certainly.
And certainly there is no time limit, you would agree, on enforcing or on challenging a void judgment, correct?
Right. The case law is clear that there's no requirement that somebody move promptly or that they have a, you know, wait. Even if you move in an unreasonable amount of time has passed, if it's void, it's void. We don't want to enforce void judgments. You know, I think that's well established. But the reason that it would be void isn't clear because here she points to Rule 54D and says, oh, well, it's an excessive judgment because it exceeds the, you know, it's different in kind, which I believe we addressed earlier or you addressed earlier, that it's not different in kind. It's damages they sought, it's damages they got. And in the complaint, it doesn't specify the amount. It doesn't say we're owed $150,000. And then when the default is entered, the principal balance is $250,000. That's not the situation we have here. We have a situation where they said, we want to prove our case at trial, our amount of damages at trial. Because Ms. Tahan and her law firm didn't file a response, they didn't have a trial. And so they submitted the documentation to show that the, you know, the damages that had been incurred or affected them. And they showed it to the court, and the court approved it. And I believe that there was no need for a hearing here because it was a sum certain, because it's not based on discretion. It's not based on a guess or a feeling from the court of like, hey, you know, emotional damages or uncertain amounts. No, there was itemization of here's where we paid, here's what we're asking for, here's why we think we're, you know, entitled to it.
What about her argument on attorney's fees?
On attorney's fees?
Yes.
So the trial court address that, and even if you say, okay, well, they weren't entitled to that, and I'm not sure one way or the other, looking back over so long, I don't know what the evidence could have shown if it had been, you know, challenged earlier, but what I can say is the trial court said it could be excessive, but it's only 3% of the total amount of the judgment at the time it was entered, which means that 97% of the judgment was okay. And it's not that, you know, it's not enough just to show that you have an excessive judgment, if that were shown, to vacate it.
Right. Okay. So maybe I'm misunderstanding you. You're talking about the excessive, her claim that the fees were excessive. I'm talking about her argument that she made to us, and I think she made it to the Superior Court as well, that you're not entitled to fees at all in this type of action as a measure of damages.
So I think that's there's two parts to that. So on the one hand, you know, the damages for a legal malpractice claim are the damages that are caused by the legal malpractice. So if I have to go hire another attorney to fix the problems, if I have to, you know, try to appeal, if I have to settle with the other side to resolve those issues, that I think those are actual damages. They're not attorney's fees that are separable from the underlying claim. As far as the attorney's fees that for obtaining the judgment, in this case, I think that would be something that the court should scrutinize for reasonableness and, you know, and that sort of thing. That's where the 3% comes from.
Okay.
Does that clarify, Your
yes.
Honor?
Thank you.
Okay, sure. So Rule 54D hasn't been violated here. And without that, the best they can do is show that, that they have a meritorious defense potentially. And by itself, under 60B6, that's not enough. And it's not a 60B4 situation because of Gonzalez that says, this is how we're going to analyze it. If it were a 60B4 situation, we have a problem administratively, because the longer you go without evaluating evidence and figuring out if damages are excessive, the more likely you are to lose that evidence, right? So had they come in a reasonable time and said, hey, court, this is excessive, here's why, then we could have conducted discovery. We could have figured out, okay, you know, what does Tejon's bills show? What do the invoices show? You know, that could have been evaluated. But if you treat that as a 60B4 motion that doesn't have a timeline, doesn't have a limit, then the evidence vanishes and they say, oh, well, we think this is flawed, so it's excessive, so go back and undo everything. And that's not a reasonable position, from what I could see of the case law, to stake out, to say that's void because we believe the damages are excessive. They shouldn't have awarded the amount that they did. So I think I have only a few minutes left, so let me see here. Ultimately, I've just mentioned this briefly. The renewal affidavit, there were two potential errors that they pointed out. One was about the statement that it was not recorded when it actually was, which is in the briefing. That's not, it's a content issue. So if you look at the case law, like Lane, Triple E, O'Brien, and others, Galloway too, unless the error in the content of the affidavit is misleading to a third party or the judgment debtor, it's not fatal. But issues like timing, if you file too early or too late, or if you file in the wrong court, those issues are strict compliance. So I think under the circumstances, the content issues with the affidavit of renewal aren't fatal to extending the judgment in this case.
Okay.
Unless there's any questions, I think I'm done.
I think we're good. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Just a couple of quick points on rebuttal. First, the fact that the judgment may have been domesticated in 2023, there's no indication, again, that's a filing. That's a procedural filing with a clerk. There's no indication that that would have given Ms. Tejon notice that this judgment was pending out there. And again, under 60B4, when she learned of the lawsuit is irrelevant. I think that the points that counsel just made go to the heart of the issue on with regards to the judgment being void because it exceeds the amounts that Kalamata could have recovered. Under 54D, the case law says that just because an amount is a claim is not for a sum certain merely because it's for a specific amount. And in considering the motion for relief, the court said exactly that. This is an amount that can be calculated, so it's for a sum certain, so a hearing was unnecessary. That directly disputes the law. But what's telling here, again, is when you look at the actual documents, AP 087 to 88 and 89, this includes $67,000 in outstanding invoices, which suggests these were amounts that Kalamata never actually paid. It includes amounts related to an appeal that they filed and then abandoned. There's no showing that this is somehow attributable to the conduct of the defendants or the appellants. There's $2,000 identified to a law firm that There's no indication of who they are. There's no nothing related to this case where they ever did an appearance. There are $27,000 in appeal settlement funds, which is over and above the amount of the settlement. Again, the purpose for 54D is to require that when a plaintiff is not sent forth the amounts they're seeking in the complaint, the court is supposed to act as the gatekeeper to ensure that excessive amounts or unrecoverable amounts are not awarded. That didn't happen here. And if the court had satisfied its obligation to hold that hearing under 54D, we would have a record that would either show why these amounts weren't recoverable or wouldn't have allowed them to be included in the judgment in the first place. That's another basis for relief and supports our motion under Rule 60B4.
Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Okay. Your time's at an end, so we thank both counsel for their helpful arguments. You've given us some good things to think about. We'll take the matter under advisement and get a decision out in due course. We're adjourned. And we'll prepare and come back for the next case in a few minutes.